And hello, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Vince, I want to thank you for interrupting your traditional 15-hour St. Patrick's Day pub crawl to record this episode.
Yeah, no. It was a real dilemma what to go with. But I decided to go with the show, obviously.
Well, we appreciate your sacrifices on behalf of the program.
Oh, no, you're buying me a beer afterwards. That's... No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I'm buying you 10 beers. You're right. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the Academy Award-winning Best Picture, Green Book. That will be in the second half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the movie news from the past week, including some slightly musical news. Michael Jackson, that classic episode of The Simpsons featuring the King of Pop, has been pulled from their air. But what does that do to further the debate about Jackson's legacy? And then, is it okay that Captain Marvel is just okay? The latest film from Marvel Studios has become the center of a debate about whether or not it's okay for a female superhero movie to be okay. So is it okay? And then finally, speaking of far from okay, we'll talk about the newest trailer for Aladdin and why the bizarreness seems to keep stacking up for this unusual Guy Ritchie project. But first, we may be days away. Actually, today may be the day, as you're listening to this program, or maybe it was announced earlier, but... there has been speculation that March 20th was going to be the day that the merger between the Walt Disney Company and 20th Century Fox would be complete, which means the bygone era of the six big studios is gone. Of course, there were many, many studios back in the day. But, yeah, it's a pretty big deal, especially since they're talking about, you know, maybe... 4,000 people losing their jobs. Some people say it could be 10,000 people losing their jobs.
So is this Disney buying out 20th Century Fox?
Right.
Is that? Okay.
Yes.
So what does this mean for the average moviegoer, let's say? Are we going to
see
more a Disney-esque version of Aliens now or what? Because
that
they
be
all get the properties that were owned by 20th Century Fox.
No, you're right. I think Aliens specifically, I think there was some talk about, you know, the Alien movies not going forward. Mostly because, you know, they haven't been terribly successful lately. Mm-hmm. But also because Disney's not really in the R-rated movie franchise business.
Right.
I think the direct impact, I want to preface this by saying a lot of the focus in movie sort of nerd-based reporting has been on when will we see X-Men in the MCU, because X-Men have been, the movie rights for X-Men have been under Fox.
Yeah, that's certainly
Everything
been the question
is,
on my mind.
I know it has. But it sort of misses the point. On the one level, all these jobs that will be lost, all these... Mm-hmm. jobs in the business. You know, not everybody can be George Clooney, but, you know, you might have a good chance of being someone in the marketing department at Fox whose job might very swiftly in the near future become obsolete because Disney, of course, has all its own marketing people. The other part of it, too, is that you have Disney, which has a remarkably large share of the movie release business, but they don't actually release as many movies as other studios like Warner Brothers and Universal and actually Fox.
Is that just because the movies they do release, they're spending three times as much than the average studio?
I would suspect that'd be a part of it. Everything they release has a $200 million price tag.
Yeah, so why do they need to acquire the studio? Why does Disney need to go around and buy up these studios?
I'm glad you asked. And this isn't, we didn't plan this. You're actually asking legitimate questions that are coming up as we're talking. But yeah, it's all about the, as you pointed out, the IP.
Mm-hmm.
Because Disney's opening up its streaming service later this year, Disney Plus. And if you have a streaming service, you have to have stuff to put on the streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
So if you buy a whole new studio
with
a whole catalog of movies and a whole catalog of TV shows and a whole catalog of stuff and channels and things, you just doubled your streaming service.
So maybe that's not the only reason they did it, but maybe it is more enticing when you look at it from that way.
I think it's the primary reason.
Right.
I don't think Disney wants to make more Alien movies. I don't think they have to. I don't think they want to make more Predator movies. I don't think they have to. I don't think they want to make a big X-Files movie or Simpsons movie or whatever else that, you know, Fox owns. I don't think they want to remake Sound of Music. Although, if in a couple of years I hear about them remaking Sound of Music, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, they're already doing West Side Story, so I wouldn't put anything off at this point. But
that's true. And that's Spielberg, too. Spielberg's remaking West Side Story.
Yeah.
Although I should say, to its credit, that he's hiring actual Latinx people to take part in West Side Story, the remake. So.
Sure, yeah. So.
Which is nice.
There's that. So their streaming service is obviously not going to be Disney-esque stuff. They're going to try and compete with the big dogs.
Yeah, they're going to try
presumably.
They're going to be like the Disney Netflix, basically.
Yeah. I don't know, man. There's already so many streaming services. It's like, how can you, and they're all getting like exclusive, really good content too. So it's like, how do you, do we really need more to choose from? I certainly don't.
Well, it's like the cable wars all over again. You know, there were so many cable channels that, you know, the more you add cable channels, the bigger your bill gets. And I mean, it's streaming is heading that same way, where once you buy, you can cut the cord and then you don't have to pay $100 to a cable company. But once you're paying $13.99 for Netflix and $4.99 for Shudder, and I think it's $8.99 when you work it out, $8.99 per month for Amazon Prime, and then however much Disney's going to be, probably in that same price range, $8.99, $9.99, you're already up to like $50.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
you don't even have the time to like consume even close to all of that stuff. It's like
my list on Netflix is at least 400 things long.
Your list?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of it is TV shows, which is itself is like an investment. If not just like 2 hours, it's like 10, 12. If it's multiple seasons, it's like 60, 70 hours.
Yeah. For me, I like to rewatch like stuff, like older stuff.
Oh, I like to rewatch stuff, you know, too, which is another layer to this. It's like there's not enough time to rewatch stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. We'll see. When do they have any plans on when their streaming service, presumably in the near or distant future, rather?
Well, Disney Plus starts later this year.
Oh, okay. All
right. There's no firm date yet. But yeah, so I mean, there's going to be anything Disney you release this year isn't going to go to Netflix. That's going automatically to Disney Plus. In fact, Captain Marvel is the first Marvel movie that's going to be on Disney Plus, not on Netflix.
Oh, interesting.
So,
okay.
Yeah, in a couple of years, there'll be no Disney stuff on Netflix. You'll have to go to Disney Plus. And the interesting thing about Disney Plus, too, is the big deal they made is like they're getting rid of the vault, you know, the Disney vault that they would release The Little Mermaid for a while and then put it back in the vault.
Right.
And it's because it's all going to be on the streaming site. So they're ripping the door off the vault.
Yeah, but I would argue it's not as satisfying as having a shelf full of Disney VHSs that you can...
In the clamshells.
Yes, exactly, that you can hoard for like 40 years. Yeah.
Oh, no, and some of them are worth money.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have like the original release of Fantasia. Which is probably really worth some money.
Because they did Fantasia 2000, didn't they? And that was what was from then on. Even on
I think
Blu-ray.
So.
Yeah.
I think so. I don't think they've re-released the original Fantasia and it's entirely. I mean, of course, that was, not to get too far into the weeds, but that was like, of course, the Walt Disney's original intention was that this would be updated from time to time.
Right.
Of course, it hasn't been updated since 2000 either, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll see what the lineup is like. I don't know. I am not tethered to any streaming service, so if, who
you
knows?
You are not streaming exclusive?
No.
Gotcha. All right. We're going to dip our toe into music, but I mean, it still touches, you know, pop culture and, you know, our realm with movies and TV in a way. the third season episode. Actually, it was the third season premiere. I didn't realize that, or I'd forgotten that. I mean, this is when I was like a kid. I remember seeing this episode for the first time. But so Stark Raving Dad is an episode of The Simpsons where Homer is sent to an insane asylum for wearing a pink shirt. It almost seems like the perfect message still 30 years later that,
yeah,
you know, you wear a pink shirt, they call you crazy.
What was it about again? Just like his dryer like made it pink, and
I think Bart put red underwear in the washing machine in with the whites.
Okay.
If I remember correctly.
And then why did he get in trouble for...
Because he's wearing a pink shirt. Everyone else was wearing a white shirt.
Okay. All right.
It's an independent thought alarm.
Okay. I remember everything when he gets to the asylum, but don't remember the setup.
Right. So in the insane asylum, he meets a big, fat, white guy named Leon Kowalski, who is voiced by Michael Jackson. The gag is that Leon Kowalski is going around telling people he's Michael Jackson, and that's the joke. So it's a classic episode. And yep. I was thinking of it, like, it was like the first – it's almost – pro forma that if you're a celebrity of any stature, you eventually make your way to The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. But this was like the first time a major, major celebrity did a voice on The Simpsons.
Really?
Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And you have to remember the context, too, that this was 91, so it was a couple of years before the first allegations came out. And it was, I think, about 5 years before there was like a formal investigation into it. I found an interesting article where it noted like at this point in his career he was like openly kind of called Wacko Jacko because like there was Neverland and Bubbles and stuff was getting around that he was eccentric, good
yeah,
word.
Yeah.
But it's funny to in this period to remember, you know, Michael Jackson before that avalanche came out because
and the episode from what I recall isn't really denigrating or mocking him in any way, is it? It's just like this kind of funny gag that fat guy is and then at the end he's like, well, I think my work here is done, and
right.
then the Michael Jackson thing just drops. So I have not seen Leaving Neverland. I do not have mm-hmm. Whatever it's on Hulu, I think
it's on
Amazon. HBO and Hulu, or just...
I think it might be available on Hulu in the States.
Okay, so I have not seen this. The writers of this episode, Al Jean, I guess, and whoever...
Who's still an executive producer.
Right.
Don't tell me there's any job security.
They, I guess, saw the documentary and were very affected by it and pulled it off. Is there anything in... Have you seen the documentary?
I've seen the first half of the documentary. I have not had the heart yet to go and watch the second
half. Is there something about the episode in the documentary, or is that just something they extracted? He might have used this episode.
Well, I read the Daily Beast.
Way.
I read the Daily Beast interview with Al Jean, and he seemed to imply that that was what he got from it. That Michael Jackson used the episode as kind of a lure, like, "Hey, come and see me on The Simpsons," because you know, kid in the '90s, Simpsons was a pretty big deal.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And of course, there.
And wasn't it just kind of in its early stages? Like
this was season three. You won't remember because you're too young. But I remember being in middle school and you know seeing on TV, and like one of them was like George Herbert Walker Bush when he was president. And I can't remember what he said, but he said we need more role models like so and so, and less role models like Bart Simpson. And there was like a controversy where. There was a contest to name a school somewhere, and the kids chose Springfield, all voted for Springfield Elementary, and everyone thought that was great until they found out the Simpsons connection, and it had to be, no, we're not going to call it. I mean, that was how controversial the show was once upon a time. Now it's like
kids were doing online trolling before online
before
trolling,
online trolling
existed
basically. Yeah. They were doing pen and paper trolling.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, it's kind of bizarre to... And I think that was another reason why Michael Jackson's appearance is so seminal, is because The Simpsons was this like crazy, kooky, subversive little thing Now it's an institution. It's like Johnny Carson now. It's like you can't imagine TV without it. But yeah, it sounded like Al Jean thought that Michael Jackson was using it as like a lure, is using it as like, hey, check me out on The Simpsons. I'm a cool guy, you know.
But it should be said that he has no proof that that's what he did, and he's only speculating. But with that being said, it's like maybe it was good to pull the episode just in light of everything. Anyway, it's like,
for the time being, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the...
They're already pulling his music from the radio, so it's like...
In some places, and I find that debate interesting because can you take Michael Jackson's music out of music history?
It's a very, very long debate. It's like... Yeah. Do any of the things that Leo Tolstoy did make War and Peace any like better or worse?
Sure.
I don't know. It's,
Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, married his underage cousin.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know,
doesn't change a note of any of his music.
Right. And I mean, you sort of want to be sensitive to the people, like the victims, but, one of the victims who was featured in Leaving Neverland said that, you know, he will be in a bar and a Michael Jackson song will come on and his toe will start tapping. And he forgets for a minute that was his abuser, because the music is so
disassociated from the person.
Well, the music is so pervasive, and this is one of the things that I think was mentioned in the documentary, that Michael Jackson wasn't just a celebrity. Mm-hmm. Like, you can shill stuff on Instagram and people will call you a celebrity now, but Michael Jackson was a living legend.
Yeah.
And when you kind of put it in that context, that what we understand as celebrity, three levels up from that, that was Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. And you can't really sort of comprehend his import on that level, especially in this day and age where, you know, again, you can go on social media and be famous, even if it's just for, you know, 5 seconds. He was famous in ways we really can't express and appreciate anymore.
Yeah.
But... I think I don't like to pull anything, but for the moment, yeah, I think that, you know, they probably made an interesting decision. It may be a matter of, like, I remember what they pulled the Simpsons episode where Homer's car is parked at the World Trade Center.
Yeah, I remember that as well.
They pulled that for, I think, about 10 years before they started putting it back in circulation as well.
Right.
So it could be a matter of...
And South Park, I think, had a joke where it's like 10 years is what it takes for something to be like funny again. It's like,
right. Yeah.
You know. Maybe not funny, but like not quite so horrific.
Yes. I mean,
which is kind of bizarre to think about as well.
I mean, when you, not to make this about 9/11, because you always stand at the brink of making everything about 9/11, but yeah, the episode itself, which is Homer. I think Barney borrows Homer's car and then forgets that it's at the World Trade Center, and the Simpsons go to New York to pick it up, and there's a boot on the car, and so Homer has to wait by the cars for the parking authority to take the boot off, which it's really more of an extended joke about New York than it is about the World Trade Center, because those towers weren't there anymore. But I think there was another article I looked at where they were talking about, this wasn't, like, the message of the episode was, you know, at the end when Leon Kowalski, or I can't remember if that was his name or not, but
I think it is, yeah.
But he reveals that there was a voice he put on to make people laugh and to make people happy. And there's the whole thing with the writing the song for Lisa's birthday. I mean, there's a lot of really positivity in that, sort of divorced from Michael Jackson. And a positivity that I think is underappreciated about The Simpsons, that it's not just about the sniping and the strangling and the catchphrases, that, you know, it was actually, I haven't watched a new episode of The Simpsons in several years, but those early ones were certainly very astute, and much more astute than anyone at the time. Many people at the time were giving it credit for when they were just looking at the controversy, and I think Stark Raving Dad is a very good example of that. It's funny, it has a message, but it's not saccharine, and it has this crazy, who would have believed, celebrity voice in the form of Michael Jackson. who also didn't take credit. Like, they didn't promote that it was Michael Jackson. Everyone sort of understood later on it was Michael Jackson because, you know, that was his voice. But
Right.
Yeah.
Fun fact, I used to have one of the largest collections of Simpsons memorabilia in the country.
Is that verified or is that just...
No, it was verified on the on this collector's website. And then as I grew older, I became very embarrassed by it. And I had them take the image off of the website. So it couldn't be verified now. So you'll just have to take my word for it.
Well, that seems like a good place to take a musical break.
I agree.
We'll be right back with more news. Listening to end credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM. That was from The Observers, and it is The Cosmic Range. That's the name of that song. Both fitting titles because, you know, as critics we observe, and The Cosmic Range could refer to the range of opinion on Captain Marvel, which we reviewed on this show. We being me and Candace, Vince's opinions on Marvel movies are more than well known.
Yes, if you frequent this program, yeah.
But it's an interesting debate. I think an interesting debate has erupted about whether or not it's okay for Captain Marvel to be okay. Because it's long been sort of understood that...
No, it's not okay. It needs to win Best Picture this year.
But I think I talked about... Alan, was it last week I talked about Alan Sepinwall mentioning that, you know, I think it was Alan Sepinwall or something else, but he put a tweet out that said he saw Captain Marvel, he thought it was okay, but he just felt like, I think he felt that there's kind of this need to really talk it up because of all the bros out there who were, you know, trying to undermine it for weeks by downvoting it on Rotten Tomatoes before having seen it. And I feel like that's the root of this question, is because is it okay that a female-led action movie that is co-directed by a female director, is it okay that these movies be okay? And this Vanity Fair op-ed is... Wasn't Vanity Fair or Vulture?
Doesn't Variety, I think.
Variety, thank you. Was that too many V's? Was that, you know what, we need more movies like this that are okay, because we need to normalize that not every movie directed by a woman or starring a woman or that is female-driven has to be perfect, has to be, like, score 10 out of 10 or, you know, 10.0 when it's measured. Because that's sort of been the standard. If you want to, you know, help improve, you know, if you're a woman in the business, if you want to keep making movies and keep making your own movies, you have to be Kathryn Bigelow. Mm-hmm. You have to get the Oscar winner, make Hurt Locker, and then, you know, okay, so clearly you're capable. Meanwhile, you know, most male directors aren't batting 1,000 every time at bat. Even Steven Spielberg, who... is at the top of his business. No, you know, The Post and, you know, what was his last one? Ready Player One. Ready Player One wasn't a success by any measurement, but yeah, he's still making movies.
Yeah. Well, you know.
That's a broad example, but, you know. But
look at somebody like Josh Trank, okay? It's like he releases that dumpster fire that was Fantastic Four and then, like, gets into a fight with the studio, completely, like, shifts the blame onto them.
Yeah.
Creates this chaos, and now he's back doing this movie, this not only a movie, but a big studio movie with Tom Hardy. And it's like, you know, at some point you do have to wonder if a woman would have gotten that same opportunity.
Especially behaving badly on set and, yeah, you know, that kind of thing. Because, you know, you have a feeling, a bunch of old studio guys hear about that behavior, going to go, oh, the director's PMSing, and then write that off. And mm-hmm. That's a great example. Because...
And even Soderbergh, right? It's like he comes out, and I know this was a long time ago, but it mm-hmm. was like he comes out with one movie and then the next three or four are complete disasters. And it's like you would not be able to do that formula nowadays, man. Like,
no.
You get one, like, bomb and it's like you're pretty much done.
Yeah. He certainly wouldn't be allowed to take the chances he takes.
Like, sure,
the distribution
yeah.
models and...
But the other side of it is like, okay, why do we like place so much significance on these kinds of movies though? It's like I went through this song and dance
the
2 years ago.
Movies, yeah.
Yes. And I went through this tirade a couple of years ago when I was like, listen, you know what I mean? You didn't go see The Beguiled. You didn't go see Detroit. You didn't go see Lady Bird. It's like, for me, those are the
right.
movies that
yeah,
you
yeah.
ought to be seeing that are actually, like, daring and taking chances and are interesting by, you
any
know, great female directors. So it's like, why are you looking at Captain Marvel to be your megaphone for female rights? I don't really get it.
Well, on top of it all... there was another article where it said, like, Captain Marvel proves that, you know, women can lead blockbusters. It's like, well, that wasn't proved with Hunger Games. That wasn't proved with Wonder Woman. That
yeah.
wasn't
and it's also like...
proof with
you,
Halloween.
If your determinant of success is box office numbers, then yeah, it probably did really well.
Right.
But I wouldn't do that anymore, okay? It's like...
Of course, but, you know, it is a determinant of success because, you know, even Kevin Feige, the head of Marvel, put a lot of the blame on, you know, it taking this long to have a female-led superhero movie in the Marvel universe. He put the blame on Elektra and Catwoman, which were movies that bombed almost 20 years ago, or at least 15 years ago. You know, they made a couple of crappy movies starring female superheroes, and the fault was... on the idea, and certainly this was perpetrated by Ike Perlmutter, who is one of the owners of Marvel Studios, that Catwoman and Elektra prove that people don't want female heroes, instead of looking at it more broadly and saying what it proves is that people don't want crappy superhero movies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then, you know, poor Lexi Alexander, who we've talked about on the show before, who directed Punisher Warzone, which is widely regarded by a lot of fans as the best Punisher,
myself
period.
Included. That is the best bad movie ever made.
Yeah.
Punisher Warzone. Love
but
it.
But she can't. You know, she's even though it's like a hardcore action movie that has hardcore action movie fans saying yes, that is awesome. We want more of that. But she can't really write her own ticket because the movie wasn't successful. Even though by and large that was the fault of marketing that came out 2 weeks before Christmas in 2008. So, you know, when you think of Christmas, you think of a guy in a skull shirt shooting people.
Yeah.
Although she's, you know, picked up some success directing on TV. Oddly enough, superhero TV shows like Arrow.
Well, I think that's what the Variety article was about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of these women have been relegated to TV. It's directing episodes here,
yeah.
there,
yeah,
and
yeah,
everywhere.
Yeah.
But it's like... they're not getting the big kind of movies.
Right, anymore. They don't get the step up. To like, usually it is you direct episodes of on TV, you stand out, maybe you win an Emmy, but, you know, you eventually get to step up and take on a bigger project. Or in the case of, you know, of actually Bowden and Fleck, the directors of Captain Marvel, you make a small independent movie and they will... open the door and
well,
and
same with the Russo brothers
and the Russo brothers too. Yeah,
yeah.
John Watt from who made Cop Out, not Cop Out. That was the Kevin Smith movie.
Yeah.
Cop Car, and then he did Spider-Man: Homecoming. So it's certainly a trend, but it seems to be a trend one way. And I wonder if Anna Fleck alone gets to make Captain Marvel, or Anna Boden, Ryan Fleck, if Anna Boden alone gets to make Captain Marvel, if there wasn't also Ryan Fleck.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. It's like, can you not write your own stuff too? It's like, why do you need these big studios to like give you these big jobs too? It's like,
well, that's where
I'm
the
just
money
trying.
Is.
Fine, but like, I'm just saying, like, you can wait around and for this, you know what I mean? Like, the article was like, well, Patty Jenkins made Monster in 2003 and then didn't get the opportunity till 2017. It's like, fine, but. You could have also have been, like, writing your own stuff, perhaps.
Well, someone
that
also has to give you the money to make your own stuff, too.
Hey, at some point, man, like, you can do something low budget enough, you know what I mean? At some point, you have to put the excuses aside and say, I'm just going to do what I have to do.
Maybe.
So I'm sympathetic to it, but I'm also not as well.
Well, I think, but I still think the double standard exists, though, because if you direct Charlize Theron to an Oscar, and I think if you're a male filmmaker, I think the next project is a
Well, we also don't know why Patty Jenkins didn't get more work. The article just says she didn't get more work. It's like you could have been the absolute, like, worst, you know, person on set for all I know.
She could have gotten 2 degrees. Yeah, fair enough, but...
So, I'm just saying, it's like...
I do want to preface before we move on to the next topic that this week we also, speaking of white male directors having it a bit easier, James Gunn was rehired for Guardians of the Galaxy Part 3. I think, not that I disagree with the decision, but I think it goes to show how silly the controversy was from the word go.
Yeah, I didn't really like keep up with that whole thing.
Well, to flashback, he said some homophobic tweets in the year 2009 and apologized for them, I think, 2012, 2013, and then somebody dug them up last summer.
Right.
Not incidentally, right before Comic-Con. But I think it speaks to how indelibly tied that he is to sort of Guardians of the Galaxy and how much of that is his voice and maybe how little the controversy seemed to matter to fans that he's back, formally back, that, seven, eight months later.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, speaking of controversies, you may have surely seen the trailer for the live-action remake of Aladdin, which seems to, if it is a success, it will be owed to a great many people hate watching it opening weekend.
Yeah, I think so.
It looks like a 90s made for TV, like Wide World of Disney kind of adaptation. It doesn't look like a big screen movie. Even watching the trailer on a computer, there's nothing, doesn't feel particularly cinematic.
I mean, it's like, why do you get Guy Ritchie to do it, man? It's like,
that is the biggest paradox of
this. It's like the big kind of like studio movies that he did before didn't seem terribly like successful. I recall one like disastrous medieval
King Arthur
movie.
Yeah, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword.
It's like, how do you look at him and decide that he is the one to like helm this gigantic project?
Yeah, it's, well, not even that, but you don't really...
Do these directors like pitch themselves? Do they go to the studio and say, I want to do this? Or do the studio reach out to them and go, I think you would be good for this?
How about a song and dance movie set in, ancient Middle East?
Mr. Ritchie, rent is coming up. You might want to look at this Aladdin movie.
Well, I think isn't he like independently wealthy?
I don't know. I probably.
But it strikes me as so bizarre. And then you get, a lot of people have mocked the blue genie version of Will Smith. But like when he's like not as the genie, when he just kind of looks like Will Smith with a bizarre hairstyle.
Yeah. He looks like Goro from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, he does look like Goro from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that looks better, but I think that also contributes to like the TV moviness feel. Like, either we don't have the confidence in the blue genie look that we don't want to show too much of it, or he's not in it that much because, it's one of these old star things. Like, I don't want to wear a mask for the whole movie. I don't want to be like a blue gleep glob for the whole movie. And the guy who plays Jafar, too, I wrote his name down that I know I can't find it. Marmon Kanzari. He does not look threatening at all.
Yeah, the whole the whole tone of the trailer seems kind of non-threatening. Like Jafar is like not threatening, and Jasmine, the princess, doesn't really seem like she's in peril really all that much. And it's like, I don't know, man. But
I don't know. Mina Massoud, who plays Aladdin, and Naomi Scott, who plays Jasmine, they're the two things I think stand out in the trailer as could be good.
Yeah.
Everything else, I think, could be bad or will be bad. But like the Will Smith genie and like the completely non-threatening Jafar, who looks like the George Costanza version of Jafar, just is not...
Well said.
It's not frightening at all.
It's like I really don't understand the trend, though, of these live-action remakes of classic films either.
Oh, but I don't get it either, because like at the end of the day, they're going to run out of animated movies to remake.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's just not going to be profitable anymore. I know a lot of people are excited about the Lion King one. I am not. I could care less about the Lion King remake.
And I don't get how people are extracting so much from these trailers either. Look, oh, it looks terrible. Oh, it looks great. And I'm just like, it looks exactly like all the other ones. Like, it looks like The Jungle Book. It looks like The Lion King. It's like, I don't know, man.
I'm not impressed with The Lion King because the trailer was like the remake of like the opening sequence of the animated Lion King. It's like, that doesn't impress me that they're able to do like a photorealistic version of that.
Yeah, yeah. Although, interestingly enough, the article you sent me had some like backstory on Aladdin. And apparently it was set in like China, and the Disney version was the one that like brought it to the Middle East and made it kind of culturally different in that way. So, you know, what it was trying to imply is that maybe they're going to be a little more sensitive to the cultural stereotypes that the Disney version did. And it's like now it seems like they're walking a tightrope. Like, we have to not be too, you know, we have to be culturally sensitive to people as well. We have to like... We have a checklist of things that we need to do.
Well, it would be a refreshing change. We're going to take a break here and then come back with our review of Green Book. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
The internet is free to serve, measures intellect by girth. Here comes another email. There goes another shemale. Social media is a trend that will send us all around the bend. Heavy is the load of a creature ill-disposed, of a man who finds the end before the start. It breaks your heart.
As my mother always said, what kind of brand new fool are you? Look at them over there. Take a good look at the officer you hit. Look at him. He's over there having a grand old time chatting up with his pals. Enjoying a nice cup of coffee. And where are you? In here, with me, who did nothing. Yet I'm the one who pays the price. I'm the one who's gonna miss the Birmingham show.
Hey, I'm gonna lose a lot of money too if you don't play Birmingham.
So that little temper tantrum, was it worth it? Hmm? You never win with violence, Tony. You only win when you maintain your dignity. Dignity always prevails.
And that was a clip from Green Book. It is the new latest film from Peter Farrelly, and it stars Viggo Mortensen, Mahershala Ali, Linda Cardellini, Sebastian Maniscalco.
This couldn't possibly be the same Peter
and
Farrelly
Joe Cortese.
That did Dumb and Dumber, could it?
Oh, it is.
Wow.
It is.
That is extraordinary.
You can't do sperm as hair gel jokes forever, I guess.
I guess not. As Jim Carrey said when he got his Golden Globe, he's like, it's going to be difficult talking out of my ass now.
Some would say it hasn't been that difficult for him to this day.
Fair enough.
But... Enough about the Peter Farrelly pass. We wanted to take a minute. We didn't do a full review of Green Book when it came out.
We didn't, no.
But because of the controversy of, you know, whether or not it was worthy to win Best Picture or not, Vince, full credit where credit is due, thought it might be interesting to revisit Green Book now that it is available on VOD, so you can go to anywhere where you can get movies online, the Apple Store, Google Play, wherever.
Or if you're like me, you are a classic movie buyer, and you go into a store and you pluck it off the shelf.
You buy physical media, like a 55-year-old post office retiree.
You make sure everyone sees you walking out of it.
See this? Yeah. It's a disc! I actually hadn't seen Green Book until recently. I will say that I thought it was fine. I think it's a charming movie in its own way. I think where I've come from on it is, you know, hearing different people, particularly people of color, talking about the movie, how it feels like it kind of talks down on the issue of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that wherever your privilege is, I think that's what, you know, if you're able to enjoy privilege, I think you're able to enjoy Green Book the more. And I think that it's what I keep coming back to is the Beaverton tweet where it said, you know, I don't remember the exact phrase, but it said, you know, Black Klansman and Black Panther to lose Oscar to movie about white guy who had a black friend that one time.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Okay, so the Oscars happen, right? Green Book wins screenplay, wins Best Picture.
I think it won a couple other awards too.
One for Mahershala Ali.
That's, yes. who I think was deserving. I think he does a really good job.
Yeah. Spike Lee causes controversy by doing a typical Spike Lee-ian thing.
Lee causes controversy when he goes to a Knicks game, but
yeah.
Go ahead.
So they announce Best Picture, and Spike Lee apparently throws a big hullabaloo. He tries to leave the theater, turns his back while they're making their speech, and, you know, made his feelings about this movie very clear. But it's like, dude, your movie, you embellished a lot of things in your movie too. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
John David Washington did not throw a brick right through the window just as Adam Driver was about to be shot by the KKK. I'm sorry. There were some things that you took as well, so your story is not totally accurate. And quite frankly, your story is not the, like, ultimate statement about race either. It's like everyone knows that the KKK are a bunch of, like, you know.
I'm not sure the president of the United States knows, but I see your meaning.
Fine. I'm not sure I would use him as, like, any measure of whatever. But,
no.
But I agree. It's something that has been weighing on me a lot because I really enjoyed this movie. Mm-hmm. I loved every minute of this movie, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a terribly flashy movie, honestly. Like,
no.
Peter Farrelly was not nominated even for directing it. Cinematography, not nominated. You know what I mean? It's just classic, good old-fashioned kind of Hollywood storytelling. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And it reminded me a lot of The Defiant Ones. Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis are like escaped convicts and they're attached to the same handcuffs or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very much kind of like that as well. And I think
later remade as Fled, I think starring Lawrence Fishburne and Stephen Baldwin.
Really?
Yes.
I'll
look that up because I'm pretty sure, I know it was a Baldwin. I'm not 100% sure if it was, yes, Stephen Baldwin.
Okay.
But back to this movie.
And it should be noted that it was written or co-written by Nick Vallelonga, who is, you know, I think Tony Vallelonga's son.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, he was invariably going to make the movie about his father, I think.
Yes.
And does it feel like Don Shirley got a bit of the, like, backseat, no pun intended.
No pun intended.
yeah, a bit. And but with that being said, it's like, I think it's being trivialized a lot. You know what I mean? I think Don Shirley was a very complicated individual. I think mm-hmm. it was more than just he was white and they were black and they kind of came together at the end and saw over their differences. It's like Don Shirley was a musical genius. He was alienated from the African-American population. He was alienated from the white population. I mean, he was a very kind of lonely person. And I think the movie is trying to like also illustrate that. There's a great moment where he says, you know, I'm not white enough. I'm not black enough. I'm not man enough. What am I? You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's when it became more about here's kind of a troubled artist. You know what I mean? And but you should be. Yeah.
I think that
I can't shake the feeling that maybe my view has been biased.
Right. You know? You're doing what I sometimes do, which is like take the devil's advocate position, which. It's important. I think a lot of it's being measured about what people wanted this movie to be or the fact that the movie exists, that it's not a, because you make a good point. It was written by the guy who's the son of the real life version of the Viggo Mortensen character, Tony Lips. Mm-hmm. and it's, whether you wanted that story from the Tony Lips side, I think Don Shirley is definitely a compelling figure, and I would like to see a movie. We can certainly do a Don Shirley movie, and you know, if Mahershala Ali could play him again and you know take it to more depths, that would be great. But I think, I think there's a lot of criticism about Green Book that is about what the movie could have been or even the fact that it exists. And I think that if this movie comes out in, you know, 2001 or, you know, heck, even 2010, I don't think it would have caused the hullabaloo about winning Best Picture that it did. I think that it sort of falls victim to the times. But, you know, at the end of the day, too, I don't want to look at a movie about what it doesn't do.
Yes.
I want to look at a movie what it does do, and one of the things also about that scene later on in the movie, I think it comes too late in the movie, because I think that a lot of this movie kind of dances around tackling issues of race directly, and that may not have been Peter Farrelly's intention, but it comes up at times.
I don't get how people keep saying that, man. It's like he was not allowed to go to the bathroom in the very place that he was playing. So it's like how is that not an example of the most blatant kind of Jim Crow racism that existed? It's like because people are not being whipped does not mean that he did not show how the times were.
No, it's I would agree with that. I would also note though that that's kind of the simplest way of showing that, and it's not just about showing it too. There's a scene where they're stopped at the side of the road to with engine trouble, and there are black farmhands in the field who they're stopping their work to see this visage before them of the white guy working on the car while the black guy kind of waits for him to finish. And you know, of course, the image of the white guy opening the door for the black guy too, it reminded me of In the Heat of the Night, when Gillespie and Tibbs are driving to the Endicott's house, and they pass by the fields of with all the black people are picking cotton, and Gillespie turns, and Tibbs is kind of like entranced by this, right? And Gillespie turns to him and says, "None of that for you, right, Virgil?" Which just the look on Tibbs's face in that moment is like, oh geez, you have given voice to what I'm thinking. This whole the idea of like there but for the grace of God, you know, he's a where he's from in Pennsylvania, he's a respected homicide detective. Down in deep south Mississippi, he's just another black guy who doesn't know his place.
Right.
And I just like a line like that contextualizes so much. But in the scene in Green Book, they're by the side of the road, and it feels like just like, hey, look at this. It just I feel like there could have been a moment there for some kind of commentary or some kind of context,
I think that would have been too on the nose. It's like the way they did it was absolutely no dialogue. It's just Mahershala Ali looking, and then you can see from his reaction that he's being moved by what he's seeing. And it's like, yeah, it didn't need any like, well, I certainly live in a different universe than my brethren.
I'm not saying that. I'm just like, I think Fairley kind of leaves it there. I think like he wants to say something, but he kind of leaves it there. I'm not saying something with words, but it just feels like it's there, is what I'm saying.
All right.
But, you know, there's a scene later on, too, not to spoil anything, but, you know, the scene later on where, you know, they're going to eat dinner and they go to the dining room of this place and no blacks are allowed, or at least not allowed to be there unless they're in a serving capacity. And, it makes Tony upset, and you know there's been this sort of back and forth at this point between Doc and Tony about, you know, dignity and not to, you know, can't answer things with violence, and that when he answers things with violence, you know, no matter how he reacts, it's a loss. So he has to react with dignity because dignity always wins, as we heard in that clip, where Doc says to Tony, it's like, well, you know, you decide, like, because he's been trying to make the point with Tony that about just how things are with the South. And I do like the message that, you know, it takes, you know, how he was, you know, this wasn't a money-making venture by any stretch. He was taking a big risk. And I hadn't heard that story about Nat King Cole, that Nat King Cole went to Birmingham and, you know, they tried to kill him. I'm not sure if it's true, but if it is true, that's astounding, that Nat King Cole, you know, who was, you know, utterly, you know, harmless, just, you know, a crooner of the times, like Dean Martin or Sammy Davis Jr. or Frank Sinatra, just a guy who got up and sang. It's, you know, there's stuff like that that I find, like, weaving in the untold history. That's the thing I like, because the best scene in Black Klansman has nothing to do with the Klan. It has to do with, it's that scene with Harry Belafonte just telling the story of that lynching in 1916.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that untold history is kind of the most compelling part.
Yeah. I think above all of that, there's just a very good, there's just a good character study here. You know what I mean? Mm. It's like, what you were saying about, you know, them talking about dignity and whatever, it's like, you know, just to kind of speak about that, it's like Don Shirley's point is that he's like, I've endured this stuff my whole life. People saying incredibly mean-spirited, racist things to me. It's like, this is just what I've had to deal with. It's like, you hear it once and you have to, like, punch him out. It's
right.
Like, it's actually Viggo Mortensen that's the very undisciplined kind of one that learns about maybe what it feels like to be in Don Shirley's shoes. You know what I mean?
And there's something to be said about the way the film also juxtaposes class, too, because Don Shirley is an educated black man who's, you know, fits very well in the rich circles that he plays for. Meanwhile, Tony Lips is working class Italian, very coarse, you know, with, you know, a lot of, shall we say, colorful metaphors in the dialogue. And that's another, I think, an interesting point that the movie touches on, too, that, you know, the most uncouth white man in certain contexts is worth more than, you know, the black guy who can play the piano like no one else, a virtuoso, which is an Italian word, as we're reminded at one point. I find the film is charming in its own right. I fear that the one of the things that's the reason it's gotten the blowback is because it's a bit out of time.
Yeah.
But again, you can't judge a movie for what it's not. And I think it's a perfectly fine, perfectly charming movie. I think the two leads, Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, are really good, and they bounce off well together. And I think it's a well-made film, and certainly, as you pointed out, a departure for certain people.
Yeah. I can certainly see why they picked it for Best Picture. It, mm-hmm. it kind of fits into that kind of formula.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
But it's... let me finish up by making this one point. Let Linda Cardellini out of the house. I can't remember the last time I didn't see Linda Cardellini in the house.
Yeah. Two things. Tom Hardy needs to breathe, and Linda Cardellini needs to get out of the house.
And, you know, maybe Christian Bale can play someone who's not fat or skinny, just normal.
Yeah.
Normal
yeah.
size.
I can see that with the director. You know, Christian, you didn't have to put on 200 pounds.
We
yeah,
have.
I wanted to. Yeah.
So that's Green Book.
Didn't need to come within an inch of your life. Yes, I did. Yeah, listen, I'm not going to spend time. If you are one of the people, and, you know, Jesse Malott, who occasionally co-hosts the show, is one of those people. We got into, not out in an argument, but maybe a heated debate about this. He's refusing to see the movie because of the political implications. It's like, whatever, man. If you're one of those people that's like, I'm not going to see this and that's going to make me feel good about myself because I'm not giving in to what they want, then I'm not going to sit here and try and convince you to see this movie, okay? If you're an adult and you are open-minded about making your own decisions about movies, then I'm saying this is a very, very good movie and you should go see it. And I think it will.
You lost you were so angry at Jesse, you lost the train of thought. But I would agree. I think that,
it's like, listen, man, I just don't have patience for people who let the media make decisions for them. It's like, I come on the show, I denigrate these Marvel movies, but even I was open-minded enough to go to Black Panther. I was like, this is it, man. I'm going in and I'm not having any biases. I am ready to be converted to this Marvel thing. I gave it a shot. It wasn't for me. And it's like... that's it. I think, you know, if I can do that, people should be a little bit more open-minded as well.
Yeah, and judge it by the movie as it is and not by the movie you wanted it to be or the times. And, you know, I think, you know, it's on... I understand not maybe not wanting to schlep out to the theater to see it, but, you know, it's on VOD now. So, it's I think it's worth checking out. And as you said, decide for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Jesse Malott, wherever you are, I hope you are safe in your... panic room for when Vince comes for you.
Yeah. That's I'll be beating it down with a Blu-ray of Green Book.
That's it for End Credits. We hope you like it. You can find more of our episodes on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Visit us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or go to Twitter, End Credits Radio there. Vince, where can people find you if they want to start a respectful dialogue?
You can check me out on Twitter at vmassin5. As you know, I have continued my quest to get a retweet from Steven Soderbergh. But
so if you know Steven Soderbergh.
Day four, no reply.
Day four. More like year four. I'll be back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. for our News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, whether you are Steven Soderbergh or not. And you can find my Politico stuff at guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next week with more End Credits Wednesday at 2 p.m. And we will see you then.